Hello, everybody. This is RCFB Talk 20, and we are starting our warm up here. I'm going to send out the announcement tweet. There she goes. And I see my co-hosts have joined me now. So welcome again, Sirius. Welcome again, JD. And one of the jokes, as I always say, or jokes is probably a strong word, but one of the issues we always run into is setting up one of these Twitter spaces. We always have to kind of take a second, and there's no green room. You just basically jump right in. So as you may have seen, we're going to be joined in a little bit by, in fact, there is our guest, Professor Michael McCann, as we get ready to talk some sports law. So there we go. That step has been done. Hey, JD, Sirius, are you with us?
Looks like we are both here, Bobic.
Yes, sir. Right. We are here.
This is like the smoothest launch into a Twitter space I think we've ever had. So, I see our guest is here too. Professor McCann, can you, is it working on your end? Well, I see you there, but when you get a chance, unmute. Otherwise, we can troubleshoot. We've gotten good at
sorry.
This.
Sorry about that.
No, don't worry. We can hear you loud and clear. So how have you been doing this evening? Thanks again for joining us. Oh, looks like we lost him. Oh, dear. Sometimes there's technical difficulties. We've run into everything as we've hosted these, but we will get him in. There he is again. We're going to go ahead and add him again as a speaker. And I think this time worked.
You hear me okay?
We can.
Great.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us. We want to kind of get this thing moving. Sometimes we're ready just in case there was time to have banter, but we don't want to waste too much time. We know a lot of you have joined us for this opportunity. I'm going to give a classic CLE introduction. That's kind of a little bit, sorry, from the background of myself and our guest. But Michael McCann is a legal analyst and senior sports legal reporter at Sportico. Prior to joining Sportico, he was a legal analyst and staff writer for Sports Illustrated from 2007 to 2020. He's an attorney, professor of law at the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law, where he's also the director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute. He's the editor of the Oxford University Press Handbook of American Sports Law, and co-author of Court Justice, The Inside Story of My Battle Against the NCAA with Ed O'Bannon, who is the my in that particular sentence. He's also authored more than 20 book chapters and law review articles, including placements in the Yale Law Journal, Boston College Law Review. And he's actually, by the way, I wanted to also congratulate on the launch of the new University of New Hampshire Sports Law Review Journal this month, where he's a faculty advisor. And in addition to all of that, he's a graduate of University of Virginia School of Law and the Harvard Law School, as well as before all of that, Georgetown. So thank you so much for joining us. I know you've been a longtime friend of RCFB. You've done several AMAs. I just wanted to thank you again for joining us. I'm Bobak. This is, we've got JD, we've got Sirius. And we're the three stooges. but we really are looking forward to an opportunity to talk to you about current topics. But before I do, real quick, the hottest topic right now is what happened in Michigan basketball. And I had an opportunity to read your article that you wrote for Sportico on, the potential issues with that fracas and educator conduct. What is your kind of thought right now on that particular issue?
Yeah, and thank you for having me on. I really appreciate that nice introduction. I think on that issue, Howard's probably not going to get fired. It sounds like that's unlikely to happen. But if you look at his contract, there's a case that it warrants a firing and that he could be fired with cause. It's different being a college coach, as we all know, than being a pro coach. They're supposed to be educators. It's really referred to in employment contracts where the role is constructed differently than it is for a pro coach. players are obviously younger, they're students. There are all of these factors that distinguish it from say a coach in the NBA or NFL doing the same thing, if there was something like that. So his contract, if the school wanted to, I think they could make a pretty good argument that he violated the contract with clause. I don't think they're going to do that. He's been suspended, obviously. So maybe they're hoping that as the news cycle changes, that people will sort of forget about it. But it was pretty bad, I think. I mean, not just him, the whole group of them to do that. It would have been bad in an NBA game, but for to be in a college game, I think is a lot worse.
I think especially for college football fans and those who are kind of more steeped in the history of it, it's hard not to think of Woody Hayes and how he ended up exiting out of Ohio State. Or even, you know, Jimmy Lake at Washington, you know, with, you know, hitting one of his own players became an issue there too. So certainly it's one that in college football comes up on a alarming basis. I mean, anything more than once, I think, is alarming, but not that frequently. I mean, there was an incident in the NFL, wasn't there? I can't remember. Was it the Bucks coach? I don't know. Maybe my co-host might remember that one. But anyway, so this is one you think they might put in the quiver for any potential future decisions. Maybe on the court performance is not becoming quite as satisfactory, and they might pull this one out again to sort of talk about a inherent issues with the coach.
Yeah, progressive discipline, right? He messed up here, and if he messes up again in some way that's connected to behavior, they're going to have a more compelling argument to say, we gave you a shot before, you didn't learn the first time, and as a result, we're now firing you with cause. In effect, this incident was a warning, and if you didn't learn from it and you continue to do things that were disruptive, then we have greater argument to fire you with cause. And this definitely goes into the human resources file. There's no question about it. And it doesn't mean he's going to get fired for cause. There are a lot of things that can happen. This could be forgotten about in 5 months. But I do think it's going to be an issue for him if anything else were to happen.
Sorry. I also can't help but think of Coach Knight, if we're talking college basketball. I remember how that kind of wrapped up at Texas. Was it Texas Tech? What was the final incident? Does anyone remember off the top of their head? I see you unmuted, Sirius.
Was that the chair throwing incident, or was that before that? He has a long history of awful, volatile temper there. But what kind of popped in my mind is you know, the classic saying that winning fixes everything. Maybe not everything, but it goes a long way. You know, talk about Jimmy Lake, and if Washington was, you know, in the running for the Pac-12 championship, let's be honest, he probably doesn't get fired. Same thing like with what happened with Urban Meyer, the Jags, the allegation that he kicked the player. You know, if the Jags were winning, it probably gets swept under the rug along with all the other stuff that was going on in his personal life. Juwan Howard was, 23-5 last year? So you got to think that he's going to get a fair amount of rope. But between what happened with the Maryland coach last year and then with Wisconsin this year, it definitely seems like if the team takes a turn for the worse, they don't perform at that same high level, that they probably have a pretty good HR file on them that they can point to say that any slight issue is just indicative of, you know, past behavior, I would assume.
And I bet we see this incident discussed in other forums, whether it be a court filing on some other case where the lawyers want to argue college sports are not about college. It's not about education. Look, you have a coach starting a fight in front of players. We could see judges reference this during hearings. I mean, this is something that could have a lot of legs beyond Howard, beyond Michigan. And it will be interesting to see if this becomes sort of a focal point, a reference point going forward.
Absolutely. And, obviously we wanted to talk about some of the other current really interesting topics. I mean, we're in a really interesting time in college sports and with players and arguably getting more power to what they can do. And one of the things at the forefront is name, image, and likeness policies, or NIL, as they're always kind of shortened. You know, one thing I would love to hear your take on, how would you explain, if you were telling somebody who's a layperson, not as steeped in college football as everyone, and especially, and one of the things I've always enjoyed about your writing is you tend to bring it in a way that I think lay people can understand. How would you summarize name, image, and likeness policies for those who are less familiar with it, or just hear it and pretend they know what it is?
Yeah, I would say it's all about the amount of money somebody can make from their identity, from who they are, whether it be because of their appearance, whether it be because of their voice, whether it be because of their athleticism, whatever it may be that makes them marketable. And sometimes it's easier to take it out of sports to say, there are entertainers, there are actors that we watch. They are getting compensated in part because of their identity. And it's a right that all Americans have. I mean, this is something that I think, you know, NIL is often viewed as this add-on right for athletes. It's not. NIL is really about restoring a right they already have that NCAA rules had suppressed, right? We all have a right of publicity. Courts have recognized it. It's the right to gain from our identity. And for most of us, it's not really worth much, right? It's just that's we're not marketable in a way that has real value. But obviously, it's different with an athlete of some recognition or an entertainer. So it's really just about saying they can make money because of who they are. So if it's Kareem Abdul-Jabbar being referenced in a commercial for GM for a car commercial without his consent, he can argue that's giving the impression that my identity is being used to sell a product. And it is something that I think if you look at it that way, it's easier to grasp, but at least for people that aren't sports fans. And then I always go back to the idea that it's not a new right. It's about saying the NCAA can no longer punish you for enjoying that right.
I can't help but think of the Jeremy Bloom incident. And that one might be a bit of a reach back for some of our listeners. But for those who aren't familiar, Jeremy Bloom played for Colorado. I think he was a wide receiver, but was also an exceptional skier. And he lost his eligibility because he did a skiing endorsement, as I recall. So, I mean, that I thought was one of those prime examples of how before these rules were in place, you had some just really unfortunate rulings in there that seemed rather, I don't know, just completely beyond any sense of right or justice. I know you wanted to add something to that, Sirius.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if Professor McCann, do you think that the current atmosphere with just use the very broad term influencers, which we're seeing can be college kids, high schoolers, even children. Do you think that that kind of helps add momentum to this when the public's seeing that, you know, more people are just able to generate income because of who they are, not necessarily because they were famous for some other reason, that actually helps athletes to, you know, justify why they should be eligible to earn this money if they can say, you know, look, I've got 100,000 Instagram followers just like the person over there giving, you know, computer reviews or video game reviews.
Yeah, it's a great point. It's a really great point because it goes at the idea that this is a right that other people have. And as you noted, the scope of people who can enjoy that right has grown through the internet and through social media and through influencing. And that's only going to increase as time goes on. So how can a college athlete sitting in class be denied a chance to make money from their identity when, like you said, the kid sitting two rows in front who's getting paid because he's a video game influencer, or the woman sitting two seats back is getting paid because she's an expert on travel, whatever it may be, right? So how are they able to capitalize? Classmates. I mean, that's really what it's about, is about classmates. Why shouldn't college athletes be treated like their classmates? I mean, that's a pretty low bar.
Professor, I have to agree with you on that, especially when it comes to, you know, being respected in the same way that your classmates would be able to earn a dollar or be able to use that influence. But one thing that I've always been really curious about with NIL is we've seen arguments before of, you know, colleges should put the money in a trust, and when these players graduate, they can get access to that money, or it should be in a management firm or something else like that. Is there any kind of legal boundary that you could see or you are aware of that now that NIL is a legal form with the NCAA and in the governing body, is there a way that they could actually hold up in court with an opportunity that says, hey, we're going to hold this money in any kind of capacity going forward?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, first of all, I would say that idea I always sort of kind of bristle at, because why should athletes' money be held, but their classmates' money from social media influencing or whatever it may be isn't held? Why are they being treated differently, really in a more paternalistic way? It just strikes me as inequitable to do that. But the question, but you're right, colleges could try to do that. We know from the O'Bannon case where Judge Wilkin came up with something like that at the district court level. So O'Bannon wins, and everyone's, I remember it was a Friday night. I was at a conference in Boston. It was 8 p.m. That ruling comes out because at least Eastern, but because it was 5 p.m. in out West, and it was a super long opinion. Everyone's like, oh, it's college athletes can do whatever they want. You get to the end of the opinion, there's the remedy. And the judge says, well, schools can keep in reserve up to $5,000 for NIL money, essentially. So a much more constrained approach than sort of a free market. And that didn't last on appeal. So it goes to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit essentially says, this is an arbitrary number. I mean, why is it 5,000? Now, they didn't get to the, at least to the same extent, the idea of this using a trust vehicle. But I think there the free market might work, where if a school wants to do that and another school doesn't, an athlete might say, I'm going to go to the school that doesn't try to take my money away and hold it in reserve. I want it sooner.
So I guess another similar and related to that is, so you say, you know, an athlete wants to have that freedom to be able to go to a different school where they can get that check. They don't have to worry about, you know, it being held up in a trust or otherwise litigated. Is there any kind of legal backing for a school to deny an NIL opportunity for one of their athletes? I imagine there's always going to be the example of, if you're under 21, you can't necessarily go out and get a Heineken commercial. But would there be any kind of legal backing for a school to step in and say, we can't let you accept that NIL check with a compliance office?
Yeah, they could. So in some states, there are restrictions on what the NIL deal can be for. So in Alabama, there are restrictions on, or at least there were until the law was taken off. But there were restrictions for alcohol, tobacco, things like that. And schools have come up with policies that have constrained what money can be on. I don't know how enforced they are, but we know that in a lot of states there are no NIL laws. So at least in theory, I guess, where the NCAA is telling schools either follow your state law or come up with your own policy, if a school decides they have real concerns about the kinds of opportunities that some of the players are going to pursue, that they're going to have a much more scrutinizing or restricted approach, they could do that, and then the response is go to a different school. I mean, where schools get in trouble is when they join hands and limit as in a cartel-like move. If on their own they decide to limit for whatever reason, maybe it's a religiously affiliated school, maybe it's a school that has a certain history where it doesn't want to be associated with certain products, whatever it may be. If a school is doing it on its own, I think it's in pretty good shape. It gets in trouble where it starts communicating with other schools and deciding, let's do this as a group.
That's a great point when you think about all sorts of institutions that have honor codes. And I always say that isn't shorthand for even religious institutions. Obviously, the service academies have honor codes as well in a secular sense. So that was a really interesting point. You know, what do you think? Are there some guardrails, some sort of common sense NIL guardrails at the NCAA could try to implement to create some level of harmony? Because I think it's interesting to see right now, as we're in kind of the reaction phase, where we're a bit of a wild west, it feels like, and maybe it's a misperception to see it that way, but are there things that if you were able to have your druthers and kind of, you know, be asked to consult and give your opinion on how they should write that, what would you think the NCAA would be best doing on this policy?
I think the NCAA would be best letting schools and conferences come up with the policies that make sense for them. That, and even if that means it's a bit of a wild west, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's a wild west because it's new and we need time to see how it works. And some of the concerns that the NCAA expressed that that they might lose fans to college sports if players are getting compensated through NIL, we haven't seen that. I don't see any data suggesting that people are not fans anymore because some of the players might get paid a little bit of money through NIL. And anything new is going to be disruptive. And that disruption will mean there will be problems. There will be athletes who might not get paid what they're owed, and there could be breach of contract lawsuits. There are athletes that maybe don't pay their taxes and that get in trouble with the IRS. I mean, there's a lot of things that are likely going to happen, and there will be news articles saying, well, this is bad. NIL is bad. This is what we fear. This is really worrisome. You know, I say, give it time, let it play out. Don't let a few bad instances sort of ruin what I think has overall been a healthy change for college sports to make it so that college athletes can be treated like their classmates. I think that's, to me, that's the right outcome. And if I were advising the NCAA, I would say allow conferences to come up with their own policies, have it be more organic rather than forced on schools. And if, again, like we talked about earlier, if a school wants to, whether it's, you mentioned Service Academy, that's a great example. If a school has a certain set of rules or policies that restrict what NIL can be for their athletes, that's fine. I don't think that's not illegal. They can act on their own. I think the problem is if the NCAA starts heavy-handedly dictating, here are these new restrictions on schools. I think that's where they're going to get in trouble.
That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I'd love to kind of head a little bit in a related direction, because one of the other major topics is what's going on with the National Labor Relations Board. And obviously, especially since last fall, there's a lot of, you know, interesting changes that could be in the works with what they've said. So one thing I want to first say, and I think this is an area, and we were kind of talking about it before we started this interview, because, you know, my background is I'm an attorney, but even then, I always ask, because I love JD and Sirius, because they're smart guys, and they can. I'm like, well, I mean, before we jump into too deep into the weeds, what's something that we should explain that people may just want to assume they know but don't know? And one of those is really, what is the NLRB, and how does it get its power, and where does that power kind of come from, and how is it authorized to act in these situations? It seems like a basic question, but we'd love to hear you explain it, because we think you give a view that would guide listeners.
Sure. So the National Labor Relations Board is a federal government agency that oversees labor relations in the U.S., so namely union management relations. And the NLRB is the agency that, on a federal level, there are state versions of it, not to get too into the weeds, but on a federal level, essentially will certify if a union is representing a group of employees, if that relationship between the employees as a union, as a bargaining unit with management are acting appropriately, whether or not their CBA, if they negotiate a CBA, is appropriate and meets the terms of labor law. So it is really the agency that looks out for the relationship between collective groups of workers when they negotiate as one. And that's, I mean, just a union itself is an interesting concept, because most workers are not in a union. Most workers negotiate their compensation with their employer on their own. So that could mean an employment contract, but more likely being hired into a wage. Obviously, a collective is different. It will have winners and losers. It means that the group of employees decide here's what we agree to in terms of wages. That might mean bad news for those who earn more than others, because the union might be more guided towards helping out those that are making less, and it becomes a series of trade-offs with management. So it's a crucial agency here, because if college athletes are recognized as employees, then that is the federal agency that would have a very important role, at least among athletes at private schools, because the National Labor Relations Act, which is the federal law, governs groups of employers, including private universities. Public universities are governed by the state version of the NLRB. So if you're in Massachusetts, it's the state labor agency. If you're in New Hampshire, it's the same. So that's where it gets a little bit tricky and more complicated, because really we're talking about two populations of schools, public and private, and the law is different from them. For public schools, it really depends on what state they're in. For private, it's federal. So I know I just said a lot. So hopefully that wasn't too much.
No, that's great. And what I was going to eventually lead to is the lawsuit that was filed this month, because it explains why they filed it against USC and UCLA. One's a private school, right. One's a public school. But in addition to, and it's so funny, I think sometimes we forget, you know, Pac-12 and NCAA are private entities. But I want to build to that in a second, because because obviously the NLRB, it's an appellate, which for those, you know, that means they review what other judges decide legally. For those of you in the audience, and they have a general counsel who acts as a prosecutor in bringing things to the NLRB. So last September, the general counsel issued a memo that got a lot of attention, and you know, especially addressing how she viewed players vis-a-vis universities. What are the important takeaways that people should realize from that memo?
Yeah, so Jennifer Abruzzo is the general counsel, and she has a labor background. So she's someone that certainly has advocated for unions, has worked for unions. And I think it's important to sort of point that out, just because her viewpoints, she's not a sort of neutral voice in this. And I don't mean that in a critical way, just, you know, everyone comes from a different walk of life. And as you mentioned, she, as the general counsel, essentially functions as a prosecutor or something in that ballpark, where she's offering a set of viewpoints that and priorities that she thinks the NLRB should adopt. Now, she's not one of the five NLRB board members, so she's not a voter. And we don't know what the five NLRB board members think. At least a couple of them are recognized as fairly conservative, so they may have different views. But this is also a topic that has strange bedfellows, where Jennifer Abruzzo, who I think most people would portray as liberal or progressive, she's citing Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who I think many would regard as conservative, but they're aligned on this, where she writes a memo that incorporates Justice Kavanaugh's concurring opinion in the Alston case, where he described the NCAA as a cartel that suppresses the wages of the workers. And he wrote, in any other industry, journalism and law, you name it, healthcare, this would be illegal, where essentially we would be saying, well, if you're a journalist, you shouldn't get paid money because you're doing it for the love of journalism. Similarly with college athletes, if you're a college athlete, you're just doing it for the love of the sport. So he wrote this very powerful critique, as we know, and she used that to say, well, wait a second, they're employees. If you look at how they function, they are functioning as employees under the National Labor Relations Act. Their hours are set by the coach, who's acting like a boss. They are producing all sorts of revenue for their school. If you were to call them something other than athletes, they would be employees. We just don't call them employees because they're athletes. And it sort of becomes a circular argument, right? They're not employees because they're college athletes. Well, that doesn't tell you anything. It's sort of a conclusion without any reasoning. So she writes this memo saying this is all wrong. And she also says the phrase student athlete is essentially illegal, that it's a way of trying to take away labor protections by using the word student athlete, which we know, and I don't want to get into it, but it has its own history, that term. dating way back to workers' comp cases in the 50s and 60s. So pretty powerful memo, but it's worth noting it's her view. We don't know what the NLRB thinks. We don't know how the board would vote if this ever gets to them. So there's a lot of unknowns.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, and that phraseology was interesting because she insists on players at academic institutions as sort of a replacement for student athletes when she was discussing it. And cites, I thought, really interesting sort of the contemporaneous societal shifts, as well as, you know, students in addition to Alston, she was talking about, I mean, you know, for those who aren't familiar, the activism on both racial justice issues, pandemic safety issues, and the concern that players had for retaliation. I think she, in the footnotes, mentioned one of the players at Wazoo who felt that they were being punished or retaliated against. Because I think that was actually something Rolo did say, really unfortunately, and got himself in a bit of trouble before they eventually 86'd him for other reasons. But, you know, one of the things that one of the takeaways, and I thought it was interesting in that particular memo, was she said, I will consider pursuing joint employer theory of liability at both the conferences and the NCAA in addition to the schools. How important is that in moving forward on these cases to try and increase player rights?
Yeah, super important, because one, it addresses the private public issue that we referenced earlier, bringing in the conferences, bringing in the NCAA. They're private, so they're governed by the NLRB. So in terms of getting jurisdiction on these entities, it's really important. Secondly, the joint employer idea, which is worth just mentioning sort of what it is. It's the idea that you might work for a company, but as your company is connected to other entities, that if your direct employer doesn't pay you, you have a right to seek wages against the parent. So a classic example would be you work at a local car dealership, and that car dealership is part of a national association. The local car dealership may have its own owner, and that's separate from the national chain, but they're still part of a national chain. If the local dealer doesn't pay you your wages, you have a legal claim against the national chain. So here, the idea is that if your college doesn't pay you, you may have a right for payment from your conference or the NCAA itself. And there's another case going on here called Johnson v. NCAA, which is in Pennsylvania. And that case falls under the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is a different federal law. But just setting that aside for a minute, that case involves athletes saying, and a judge, Judge Padova, who's 86-year-old federal judge, who clearly is a sharp critic of the NCAA, he's saying, look, they're employees of the NCAA, because the NCAA is determining how colleges recruit. It sets rules, it sets penalties, it limits the number of hours that athletes can essentially work. Those hours aren't often enforced. So there's a lot going on here, all of which is saying the NCAA and conferences have a clear stake in this employment relationship, this alleged employment relationship between the athlete and his or her school. And that's really worrisome. I would be worried if I was the NCAA, and I'd be worried if I was a conference, because that could mean they're on the hook to pay.
Absolutely. And I want to say we respect your time here. I apologize. I should do a time check. We're at 34. I don't know if you have time to stay on, because I'd love to keep asking a few on this topic if you have the time.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you got it.
I apologize. Because, I mean, obviously Johnson versus the NCAA, it's a current case. I know it's before the Third Circuit, at least I believe. Didn't they appeal that? That decision. But the concern is, how do you think, because there were two previous cases just off the, and you mentioned them in your own write-up. And again, I recommend any opportunity you get, go to Sportico, read Professor McCann's writing there. It's exceptional. But Dawson versus NCAA in 2019, Berger versus NCAA in 2016, were both on the Fair Labor Standards Act. And both of them tried to get that joint employer argument and failed at the appellate level, at the Ninth Circuit and Seventh Circuit, respectively. What Do you think there will be a shift now that we've had Alston and I don't know how much influence the NLRB memo would have, but the how much do you think there's going to be a change eventually on this? And do you think this Johnson case may have a better opportunity than those previous cases?
It really could, and I do think there has to be some sort of change coming, because there are so many attempts to make it happen, and eventually one is going to work. And it may not be this year, it may not be next year, but we're within the boundary of a handful of years where I think there will be a seismic shift in the relationship between college athletes and their school, and by extension, their conference and the NCAA, that's going to lead to all sorts of choices for schools about sports, about which sports they keep, about how they compensate athletes, whether the athletes unionize. There's a lot coming. It's not immediate, but it's clearly, if you look over this, you know, look down the road, it's there. And the as you mentioned, the joint employer argument has failed so far. It failed in the Ninth Circuit, it failed in the Seventh Circuit. Both circuits said essentially, no, the NCAA is not an employer. It regulates college sports. It can't take on the function of an employer because college athletes are subject to amateurism, and amateurism prevents payment for athletic-related expenses. You mentioned Alston. I think Alston helps, and the Abruzzo memo helps. But if we want to play devil's advocate, Alston was maybe a smaller case than the amount of media attention it got. It really was about academic related expenses. It did not address what we think about with college sports, which is athletics, right? Compensation for playing a sport. And we don't know what would have happened if that was the issue that the court voted on. We know where Justice Kavanaugh came down, but he was by himself with his concurring opinion. Who knows with the other eight, how they would have voted. I think Justice Breyer, although he's retiring, would have clearly voted against the players in that, if had that been the question. And I have a feeling at least two or three of the other justices would have as well. It would have been a much more divided opinion. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we don't know how the Third Circuit's going to react to it. So far, that argument's 0-2. But, you know, if you go to all the circuits, you probably win one eventually, right?
Absolutely. You know, and when I would explain this to my own students, I would say, you know, it was a unanimous opinion, and then Kavanaugh had some more stuff he wanted to say that the others were kind of like, okay, you do you, you know?
I mean, right.
Go for it, Haas. you know, and one other thing that, as you were talking, that I always caution people who aren't as familiar with the unfortunate factor is the wheels of justice turn really slowly. Yeah. I mean, and the scales of justice fall hard on Mrs. Paul's graph, but that's a totally different topic. And I apologize for some of that. That's maybe five people in our audience who'll get that joke. But, you know, this brings us to one topic I really wanted to get to was the, you know, February 8th, the National College Players Association filed a lawsuit against the NCAA, Pac-12, and then, you know, the frenemies, USC and UCLA. We touched on that a little bit ago, but who are the NCPA, the National College Players Association?
Well, Imogi Huma and others are involved with that group, and they are essentially saying, I mean, for similar reasons that we mentioned, they're arguing that the players are employees, that joint employer recognition is appropriate, and they bring in the conferences and the NCAA to get the private actors in there. And they are an entity that I think if college athletes become recognized as employees, they would play a pretty instrumental role in forming unions and helping them form unions and helping them collectively bargain. So they would have a pretty big stake in the outcome. And, you know, it's going to be an interesting issue if college athletes are employees and if they unionize. It's a different pool of workers than a lot of other workers. I mean, they're only there, what, 4 years? A lot of them leave. Basketball players obviously can leave. They can leave after one. Football players may leave after a few years. Do they really want to be in a union? I don't know. I mean, to me, I don't think it's as straightforward as maybe sort of the Twitter world might forecast. I think there are a lot of athletes that may say, you know, I just want to, I'm just going to play. I can get NIL. I don't know if I want to get involved with the union. My goal is to get to the pro leagues. Whereas maybe a union will help those that don't have the same pro prospects, where they're not going to the NFL, they're not going to the NBA or WNBA or whatever it may be. And they may really benefit from having a collective voice, especially in things like video games, where on their own, a lot of players aren't marketable for a video game, but if they're part of the Notre Dame team or whatever it may be, then they have real value. So I think there are all sorts of interesting issues with this, with what you just referenced, but also just sort of the larger picture.
So timeline-wise, I know this is, again, going before the NLRB's sort of regional office, I guess in Los Angeles, to review the case and determine whether or not they'll even do anything on it. How long does that even take in these circumstances?
Yeah, we're talking – let me put it this way. The Northwestern matter took 2.5 years. So if there's an – so the way the process works is the charge is filed. The NLRB will send agents to investigate, meaning they will try to interview people. I guess here it would be at UCLA and USC and the conference and maybe the NCAA and ask them questions about the relationship between athletes and their schools and by extension the conference. There will be some sort of light discovery that happens. That will be a period of months. We'll probably hear a decision, I'm guessing, by the regional director of the NLRB in Los Angeles, maybe this year, but probably more likely not this year. And then whatever that decision is, certainly if it's adverse to the NCAA, they will petition the NLRB in DC to review it. And then we sort of, we see through the tinted windows. We have no idea how this board will react to this. If we remember Northwestern, remember the regional director's ruling, and everyone was like, oh, college athletes are employees. People were celebrating. Then it gets to the NLRB in DC and they vote 5-0. No, they say we're not exercising jurisdiction. And I'm not saying that's going to happen here, but you mentioned the wheels of justice move slow. I mean, the wheels of administrative process may be even slower. And this is not going to be an overnight thing. And nor should it really, because it's a really important thing and there should be deliberation.
What do you think may distinguish what happened with that Northwestern case and what we're seeing here with this new case filed by the NCPA?
So one key distinction is the joint employer argument, and that it's not just the school as the employer, that it's going beyond that. That may have more legs potentially, because it really puts the issue in the better or more appropriate light, right? When you think of a college athlete, if you think, oh, well, their school is really not their employer because they're a student there at the end of the day, and they're getting reimbursement for tuition. But then you extend it to say, well, but what about this? What's this conference doing? Like, they're not an educator. They're clearly a professional organization that's looking out for financial interests. It seems like a more commercialized relationship for the athlete at that point, and then bring it out to the NCAA, which is clearly focused on commercial interests. I mean, it also has academic interests, but this is where I think where the argument may be more persuasive, because it's no longer just thinking, oh, the college and the student who plays a sport, and it's really at the end of the day, they're a student there. They're not a student at the conference. Right. I mean, the conference is there to generate revenue. And that's why I think maybe that's a distinction that could help the players.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, one of the questions is we were kind of discussing was also how sort of these new. Well, and I mean, what? Well, one thing, actually, let me take one step back. Clearly, I think, has this been the NCPA case, was this the first one to truly take advantage of the memo from last September that gave them kind of a direction of how to form their case? as they filed it.
This is certainly the one that's getting the most attention. There was another one last fall by Michael Sue, who has a similar entity representing college athletes, and he's a former provost at Minnesota. He also filed one because an NLRB petition, there's no standing requirement, essentially. Anybody can express a claim. So his also drew on these arguments, though this more recent one is more extensive in terms of its briefing and in terms of what's been argued. But clearly this is new, right? This is drawing on, Alston is drawing on the Abruzzo memo, and it has a different set of legs than what the Northwestern players had. And when Northwestern players brought it, it was really, I don't want to say out of nowhere, but it was not based on sort of a trajectory of events. It was really based on the argument that they felt that they're functioning as employees and they should be recognized as employees. This, I think, Bobak, as you're sort of alluding to, this is sort of on a chain of events, and that might make it stronger.
You know, one thing, and it's interesting, we were just sort of, as you were answering it, sort of talking among ourselves about potential follow-up, you know, with the increase in media deals. Now, obviously, every time they renew, these deals are enormous. So the new, you know, SEC ESPN deal is for $3 billion. How much, I mean, it's hard not to hear that number and then wonder where these players will have an opportunity to get their own piece of that beyond, you know, making odd deals with the local Pizza Hut or whatever. Some of the NIL right. deals are cute and everything. But when you realize the amount of money that's out there, it's hard not to think that they're just thrilled that the players are getting these you know, relative pennies compared to what they could be getting. How much of a change do you see coming in that? And what are some of the things the players could do to get a bigger chunk of it?
So on that, I think one case to watch is House versus NCAA. That's the case out in the Ninth District Court, Northern District of California, Judge Wilkin. It's the case involving Sedona Prince, where they're arguing that why was it that now NIL is okay with amateurism, but it wasn't okay before? They argue that colleges owe money for NIL-related benefits that were denied from 2016, which is as far back as it can go in terms of the statute of limitations, to 2021. So and the interesting thing about that case is that they're defining NIL much more broadly. They're defining it to include broadcasting rights. And that is certainly a lot broader than what has traditionally been the conception of NIL as individual rights to do endorsement deals and sponsorships. This is saying, if you're on TV, if you're on ESPN or whatever, and you weren't paid, you should have been, because after all, NBA players and NFL players and NHL players and all of them, they get paid. They get a share of TV deals through collective bargaining. So that's interesting. Now, the hiccup in that case potentially is that in the O'Bannon case, Judge Wilkin really limited, rejected that argument that players are owed compensation for the use of their image on a television broadcast. So we'll see how it shakes out, but that's a case that is worth watching that really goes to that question.
It would seem like that kind of also ties into what you mentioned with the changing tides in public perception as well, and the influence that can have on the courts in terms of whether or not these players are just student athletes or if they're, you know, players at an academic institution, in terms of the public seeing going up. The school's getting, you know, $200 million over the next 10 years for this media deal. They're going to get $70 million for that. Coaches are getting $100 million full guaranteed contracts. The sums of money that just keep getting bigger and bigger. And as many point out, well, when you don't have to pay the players, then obviously you have a lot more money that you can spend on other things. That would also contribute towards trying to influence public opinion, and then through that, the courts as well, I would assume.
Yeah, and I think this is something that Alston's attorneys, Jeffrey Kessler, and David Greenspan in particular. I remember David Greenspan, who was one of the lawyers that works with Jeffrey Kessler. He spoke to my class several years ago, and he really, to me, so well captured what this is all about. He says, all of these schools are spending money. You mentioned coaches, right? Huge salaries, new stadiums, new fitness centers, better laser tag within the facility, all of these things. They are spending money on everything around the athlete to convince him or her to attend the school and stay at that school. Well, why not just pay the athlete? Why is it that you pay everything around him or her? And that's a pretty powerful, straightforward argument that I think would have traction with judges. It certainly had traction with Justice Kavanaugh, because that was going to the heart of what he was asking in oral argument, that this is really about not paying the person that's generating the wealth. And not only not paying that person, but paying everything around him or her, because you can't pay them, but you still want to convince them to come and stay. It's an extraordinary arrangement that, to me, won't withstand continued legal attacks. Eventually, it won't work.
I think we see that in some other industries too, where you have a small company that pursues a niche kind of product or manufacturing process, whatever, and they're like, look at how profitable this is. Why doesn't the overall industry do the same thing? And then you look at more closely, and it's like, okay, but you also have volunteers and unpaid interns that are doing a lot of this labor for you, and that's how you're magically able to have this high profitability ratio, because you're not following the same rules that literally every other employer is. Magic free labor. It's a great thing if you can get it.
Yeah, and we've all had internships where we're not paid. I mean, it's sort of I guess it's sort of a rite of passage, and maybe the worry is we don't. I mean, this is an issue for law students, right, where they may get an internship where it doesn't pay, but it's really important for them to learn skills. Schools now try to come up with money to sort of give them stipends, but in a way, you're right. It is sort of this free labor where, of course, businesses are profitable when the workers aren't getting paid.
We want to keep respecting your time here, and I apologize for checking again, but do you have time or do you need to wrap up? We don't want to keep you on the hook for too long. We're absolutely, utterly intrigued by this discussion.
Are there people listening? I mean, let's keep going. Or if there's...
There's people listening. In fact, there's even a couple of hands up.
I think he's mostly just concerned making sure that the check for the billable hours, we either hold it at 1 hour or we need to take it up to the next.
No. So. We bill to a sixth of a minute. Don't you dare think that it's for an hour or not. Well, we're not plebes here. No.
The three of you are joint employers. I'm calling you joint employers. So one of you doesn't pay, the other two are.
Reddit would love this conversation, considering we're all moderators who are totally unpaid labor. we're doing it for the exposure. No.
you accept expired Taco Bell coupons, right?
Sure, you got it. It still tastes good.
Yeah, before I do forget, for those of you listening, I have to say there's an upcoming panel that Professor McCann's going to be on at the Aspen Institute, The Future of College Sports Athletes as University Employees. And it's a really interesting panel, including Bob Bowlesby. So I do recommend checking that out. I saw that. If you check out Professor McCann's Twitter, there's a link to that. It's going to be on Friday, this Friday, February 25th, from noon to 1 p.m. Eastern time. I just wanted to mention that because I saw that and I was like, wow, that's actually, that could be a really, really interesting one. One question we did want to get to, and it's one that when we announced that this talk was happening on the Reddit webpage, gosh, I sound like an old person when I say that. But one of the questions we had was actually involving this whole brouhaha, which is fascinating, between Conference USA and three of their members who are departing, Old Dominion, Marshall, and Southern Miss. Just today, Marshall has apparently filed a suit alleging that the current rules that the Conference USA is operating under, including the arbitration clause that they want to enforce, were not in effect at the time they joined. When I hear all of this, I'm waiting to hear that they've settled. But what is your thought on what's going on right now with Conference USA and their and these teams that are spurning them?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. This ends in a settlement. This is not something that's going to have legs beyond them reaching some sort of mutual agreement where people are paid and they move on. With this clause, I mean, I guess the narrow legal question is going to be, when they joined, are they is it sort of frozen at that point in terms of arbitration rights or arbitration obligations? Or by being members when arbitration became required, did they consent to that? I mean, we don't know. I think that to me is going to be sort of the narrow legal question about whether or not, even though there wasn't arbitration when they joined, that doesn't mean as a member of an organization, you aren't bound by arbitration later. So I do think that something like this it almost always ends in some sort of settlement. But yeah, I mean, look, this is kind of the fun nature of college sports and the law, that something like this should have an easy answer. Does arbitration apply or not? And the fact that there are competing arguments about something so basic really goes to maybe the haste at which schools enter into conference arrangements without thinking through what that means going forward, or maybe it's lack of communication while they're members about changes in rules. I don't know.
Hey, Adam, I just let you up because I saw you were hanging out there for a while. Did you have a question?
I do, and I want to say thank you, Mr. McCann, for doing this, because I'm a football coach actually looking for a job right now, but I'm very interested in kind of the sports and legal law that's going on here, and especially present day. But my question is, do you ever see with the present kind of system and what you were just talking about where, you know, universities are not saying or we're not saying that student athletes were employees, do you ever think it will become down to, you know, these big time athletes that are already drawing millions as high school kids? Do you think it will become where they get a piece of the revenue for TV, and the school then charges them as kind of like a, you know, they're their own independent entity, but they're using our company name to forward their brand? Do you ever think that type of thing could happen, or you know, what type of legal sense would that make, if any? Because I've heard some people talk about it, but I'm not really fully sure about it.
Yeah, thanks, Adam, for the question. So I would say the short answer is yes. And I think if college athletes are either recognized as employees, or if they're able to form some sort of trade association without being employees, which is another possibility. We didn't get into that, but that's sort of another potential channel. In that arrangement, they and the school could come up with some sort of policy that goes into what you're saying, because you're making a good point. If you're playing at a school, you're wearing their uniform, you're playing as part of a system, it's amplifying your brand, it's amplifying your skill set, you're getting something in return for what you're doing for the school. So the school can make a pretty credible argument that this is not a one-way street. It's not just a player shows up and that player is generating all of the attention. They're obviously part of a team structure. And in an arrangement like that, where the school and the players could say, okay, here is how it's going to work in terms of revenue. But to me, that invites the question of how are players going to get paid the same if they're in a union? Will the quarterback get paid more? Should the quarterback get paid more? I mean, in the NFL, we'd say yes. Or how about if there's a deal on intellectual property licensing, whether it be broadcast money, whether it be apparel or sponsorships, things like that? Is that money going to be split between players and the school, or players and the school and the conference? And the split that goes to the players, is it divided evenly? even if some players did more than others. There are real distribution questions that I think might lead to debates.
I think one of the more interesting things that we've seen in the past couple of, especially the past couple of weeks, has been this move to finally getting personalized jerseys going again, with player names and different schools coming up with different solutions to how to sort of split revenue in allowing, because I went to a school that didn't have names on the back of jerseys, one of a handful that didn't, so they could totally get away with just doing a number on a jersey when they would sell it and everyone knew exactly who that was. But it's been interesting to see that and how different universities have been reacting to it. We had one oddball question, and the guy said it's an odd question, and maybe it's one I was curious if you were familiar with this, but it's a very quite a legitimate legal topic, or at least business topic, and it had to do with actually soccer in college sports, because training compensation and solidarity payments are this whole thing in FIFA. And so when training compensations happen, there was an example of a player who had been through the MLS and had been through a youth league, where under the FIFA rules, his youth team would have gotten like $700,000 of his $71 million deal. So the question was, what would have to happen so that a player who might have come out of an American university, college soccer program, presumably trained through it, because, player development is certainly a major aspect of any collegiate program and any sport. What would happen if we had a player like that, who, I'm not saying necessarily became the next Messi, but, ends up in the Premier League or Bundesliga and ends up doing quite well? Would we ever reach a point where we could see a university kind of knocking on the door and saying, it's not a huge amount of money, but it's significant. It's worth, legal action amount of money. I mean, have you ever encountered this? Is this something that you've ever kind of considered in the college university universe?
I haven't, but it's a really interesting question. I the question to me would be sort of the reach of that policy. Does it go into a college sports environment, right? That they are not bound by rules governing pro sports. So in that context, maybe they wouldn't be eligible for it. I'd have to think it through further. It's a really interesting question that, especially if college athletes become employees, that, well, then they are kind of our pro sports. So maybe there's a better argument there.
Yeah, and I think it was, from what I understand, a voluntary thing. I think MLS finally decided to become part of it because they realized they had spent all their own money on that developmental program. And then that left the question, could college programs, either via the NCAA or something, join that? And then, have this kind of, sweepstakes where suddenly one of your players ends up becoming a superstar in Europe. I mean, it's funny, we keep having to say Europe because they pay the crazy amounts of money for soccer players.
But here's the thing. Then the school loses its tax-exempt status, right? I mean, that to me would endanger that, because at that point it really seems like if it's aligned with Major League Soccer and by extension FIFA, it's really operating in a pro capacity. So I think the tax break that they're getting would be, I mean, I'm just making this up as I talk. I'm just thinking in my head aloud, right? Like I would be worried if I were the accountant for the school to do something like that.
I think that is a great point. I think that, especially as you said that out, I mean, and it's so funny when we were discussing whether to bring this question up, I said, we're going to probably be thinking aloud. Exactly. It's going to be think like a lawyer, sort of sort through the issues as you hear them. There's somebody that we know who's taking the bar in Florida actually this week. So he's doing that on his own, not to kind of go back to those days. But, we've now hit about an hour. So this is typically when we like to wrap up, and we respect, the amount of time you took speak with us. And, thank you so much. I mean, this has been one of the more interesting talks I think we've ever hosted.
Well, I really appreciate you having me on. It's a lot of fun to talk through these issues, and the discussion was awesome. Thank you for everyone listening. I hope I was interesting, and looking forward to following what happens. There's so much going on.
Absolutely. We live in interesting times when it comes to so many of these topics that have been otherwise stale, or at least fairly relatively stagnant for decades. So again, I encourage all of you, if you haven't, follow Professor McCann. You can see his, obviously you can see his Twitter right now if you're on with us right now. Read his articles on Sportico. They're excellent. Check out, if you get a chance, that panel at the Aspen Institute this Friday. You'll find that link in his Twitter feed to register for that. But we, on behalf of myself, on behalf of JD and Sirius, we wanted to thank all of you out there for listening in to this RCFB talk, where we talked about a lot of sports law issues with Professor Michael McCann. We hope you all have a wonderful week. Thank you for joining us. Have a great night.